Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Knife. This is Patrick Georgioff. I want you to imagine this. It's 2 a.m. and you're rushing a hypotensive trauma patient to the operating room for exploration. Maybe you need to go into the neck, the chest, or the abdomen. Are you prepared for what you might find? Trauma educational resources are extremely limited, and that's why we created the Trauma Surgery Video Atlas. 24 challenging scenarios with high-yield text, beautiful illustrations, and stunning professional-grade video that walks you through the approach and management of devastating injuries in a step-by-step fashion. Check out the link in the show notes for more. There are group discounts available as well. Now, enjoy the episode and dominate the day.
Welcome to our first trauma subspecialty podcast with a challenging clinical case from London in the UK. We're excited to bring some more British voices to the Behind the Knife catalogue. Today, we'll discuss a case from the UK's longest established major trauma centre and one of the busiest in Europe. I'm Prash Ramaraj, a surgical trainee, similar to PGY5 in the Edinburgh rotation, a former medical student down in London and a trauma sciences MSc student at Queen Mary's University of London / the Royal London. Joining me today is Roisin Kelly.
Hi, I'm Roisin Kelly. I'm a clinical fellow similar to PGY3, working in the major trauma department at the Royal London Hospital. We also have with us my colleague, Max Marsden.
Thanks, Roisin. My name's Max Marsden. I'm a trauma fellow in resuscitated trauma surgery here at the Royal London, and I also work for the British Army. And lastly, we have my colleague, Mr. Chris Aylwin.
Thank you, Max. Yes. Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Aylwin. I'm a consultant or attending trauma surgeon at the Royal London Hospital. I'm also a clinical academic and I head up the master's program in trauma sciences at our local university, Queen Mary University of London.
So thanks very much for the introductions, team. We've got a lot to unpick from today's case. So without further ado, Roisin, would you start us off with this patient's journey?
Yes, of course. So our patient is an 18-year-old male. He was assaulted with a bladed weapon on a Saturday afternoon and remarkably managed to walk into a store, having sustained a stab wound to his posterior left axillary region. Alarm bells were immediately ringing as bystanders noticed large amounts of bleeding. And this is when the clock really starts ticking. The initial 999 call came in at 16:07 as bystanders waved down a passing ambulance, who, upon completing a dynamic risk assessment, called for immediate assistance. It happened that one of the bystanders was a GP who happened to be on the scene, and they assisted paramedics in packing the wound with some gauze, which is an excellent example of immediate and effective first aid from a trained professional. The paramedics also gained IV access, a crucial step for this bleeding patient. 15 minutes after the initial 999 call, London Air Ambulance arrived on scene, where the more advanced pre-hospital interventions began. This team had an emergency medicine consultant and advanced paramedic with them. The team applied 1.5 packs of Celox gauze to the stab wound and a pressure dressing whilst completing a full stat check. At this point, the patient's clinical picture was concerning, with a significant volume of blood on the floor. Radial pulses were not palpable bilaterally and the patient was clammy, however did have a GCS of 15. Given this clinical picture, the team decided to transfuse 1 unit of packed red cells, 1 unit of FFP and 2 grams of TXA. With incredible efficiency, the team left the scene just 11 minutes later en route to the Royal London Hospital, arriving at 16:50. This is a total pre-hospital time of 43 minutes from the initial 999 call to hospital arrival. In trauma, every minute counts, and this was an impressively swift transfer.
Okay, thanks very much, Roisin, for taking us through the pre-hospital journey. This sounds like a really sick patient who's going to need a quick response from the trauma team at the London Major Trauma Centre, which is equivalent to a level 1 major trauma centre in the US. There are a few topics for us to unpick from the pre-hospital journey. Firstly, this patient has a junctional injury, and we know that junctional vascular injuries carry increased mortality compared to vascular injuries to the extremities. These are relatively common injuries at another London major trauma centre, and most commonly present out of hours when staffing is reduced, and they tend to be resource intensive especially in terms of blood product use, imaging use, and theatre, which is the operating room usage. A key issue includes that we can't get a tourniquet around them in the pre-hospital world as easily as an extremity vascular injury, meaning that proximal control is more challenging. There is some novel experimental research into specific axillary and groin tourniquets to see if these will help hemorrhage control in the pre-hospital world and in the emergency department, which is the emergency room, though these aren't yet in routine clinical practice. Rasheen, the air ambulance team gave this patient some pre-hospital blood, which is an intervention not universally seen in trauma systems. Could you tell us a bit more about pre-hospital blood?
Yes, of course. Since 2012, the London Air Ambulance Trauma Response Teams carry both red cells and pre-thawed fresh frozen plasma. The most recent systematic review on pre-hospital blood in 2019 suggests a reduction in mortality with pre-hospital blood product resuscitation. However, an issue is that we haven't yet standardized decision-making in who gets pre-hospital blood, nor in what order to give these products.
So what happened next when they arrived in the ED?
So when the patient arrived in the emergency department, the major hemorrhage protocol was activated, which released two packs of blood products. So you have pack A and pack B. Pack A contains 4 units of red blood cells, 4 units of fresh frozen plasma, and pack B contains a further 4 units of red blood cells, 4 units of fresh frozen plasma, 1 unit of platelets, and 2 pools of cryoprecipitate. The blood bank continues to thaw group and antigen specific pack B blood products in a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio until the call is deactivated and the hospital resources this with a dedicated porter to keep bringing blood to the trauma bay. This is based off a number of papers over the past 20 years focusing on the 1-to-1-to-1 ratio of blood products. There have been a few studies run from our centre finding no benefit to earlier increased volume use of cryoprecipitate compared with 1-to-1-to-1 standard of care, nor the use of BHAs versus conventional coagulation tests in the primary outcome of 24-hour survival or any secondary outcome other than in the specific subgroup of 28-day mortality in severe traumatic brain injury.
Okay, thanks very much, Rasheen. So just for the listeners, VHAs are viscoelastic hemostatic assays like RATEMs and TEGs. So if you're interested in some of the papers we've talked about, we'll reference them in the transcript. But moving swiftly on, this patient's in the trauma bay. There's ongoing blood product resuscitation and the on-call trauma surgeons are present to review the patient. Max, could you take us through the surgical decision-making for this patient and your thought process when you saw him in the trauma bay?
Yeah, thanks, Prash. So I had been pre-alerted by the pre-hospital team that this was a hemorrhagic or hemorrhaging patient. And he was met then in the emergency department with a full trauma team, which included surgeons, physicians from the emergency department and anaesthetists, as well as nurses with rapid infusers ready to go. So we repeat the primary survey when the patient arrived. And the first thing we look for is evidence of catastrophic hemorrhage. This patient had a posteriorly placed wound just around the scapula, as you mentioned before, which had been really well packed and wasn't actively bleeding by the pre-hospital team. So his sort of initial hemodynamics were reassuring compared to what we were told his initial pre-hospital hemodynamic status had been like. So he had a heart rate of 110. He had a blood pressure with a systolic greater than 110 as well. And he'd only really received 1 unit of red cells and 1 unit of plasma in the pre-hospital phase of care. So we were quite reassured by that. He had a head-to-toe search for other penetrating wounds and none for him were found. The rest of the primary survey was remarkably normal. So he had a normal examination of his chest and the primary survey chest x-ray was also relatively normal. His abdomen was also normal. An extended fast examination for him was normal as well. With that information, we decided he was a fluid responder and we had a little bit more time to try and understand the exact anatomical nature of this injury. And so opted to take him through to the CT scanner, which in our hospital is right next to the emergency department resuscitation bay. So really only a matter of moving the patient a few meters. once we understood exactly where the injury was, plan our operation, and also brings into play potentially endovascular options or even a hybrid option. And I think that's only really possible once you've imaged the injury. I think if this patient wasn't a fluid responder and were hemodynamically deteriorating, we'd take the patient immediately to the operating room and do a rapid dissection down onto the clavian artery.
Yeah, thanks very much for talking through that difficult decision-making in the trauma bay from the surgical team, Max. Interestingly, the paramedics had mentioned that there were no radial pulses palpated. And of course, this guy has a axillary artery injury as well. So absence of a pulse is a hard vascular sign, which would usually mean let's go straight to the operating theatre. But obviously here we decided to take them through the CT scanner. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. We had a hard sign of vascular injury because, as you say, on the injured side, he still didn't have a radial pulse. And on the uninjured side, he'd now restored, if you like, a radial pulse. So it wasn't due to hypoperfusion. I think the really remarkable thing about this case is that this junctional injury had been sufficiently packed with a topical hemostatic that we'd got hemorrhage control. And in that context with normal hemodynamics, I think whilst we potentially did break the rules, we did have a hard vascular sign, the additional information from CT scanning was helpful.
Okay, Max, thanks very much for talking us through the decision-making. So now on to the juicy bit, the operation itself. So what did you do? What did you find? How did you fix it?
Thanks, Prash. So we transferred the patient to the operating room and I called in a trauma vascular colleague to help with this, as my training up to this point has been largely general surgery. It's interesting because, you know, the packing and the wound was all from the patient's posterior aspect. So lying the patient supine and approaching the wound from the front, it just took me a second to kind of get my head around. The incision was an infraclavicular incision, and using, you know, standard trauma strategy, we got proximal and distal control before entering the zone of injury. There's a really good video in the Behind the Knife Trauma Atlas on how you do this. It can be a bit fiddly and you have to sort of dissect through pec major, take down pec minor. For this patient, his injury was actually directly below the pec minor. So once we got proximal and distal control, we then found a transected axillary artery. And we're fortunate that the two ends seemed to come together without undue tension and performed a primary repair with proline. And again, I think what's really remarkable about this case is that the packing had managed to completely stop the bleeding. And so that packing could then be removed from the posterior aspect of the patient once we'd got surgical hemorrhage control.
Okay, so thanks, Max. Quite a lot of points to unpick there, actually. So maybe bringing in your vascular colleague, Max and Mr. Elwin, could you talk us briefly through sort of the choice of incision for this tricky junctional injury, pros and cons of different vascular repairs in this area as well?
Shall I take this, Max?
Yeah, that would be great, Mr. Elwin.
Okay, so I was not the operating surgeon, but these sort of areas can be really challenging, even for the most experienced vascular and or trauma surgeon. I think it's probably worth saying, or at least backing up the decision making for a CT angiogram in this patient with hard vascular signs, which, as our teaching tells us, should normally mean that we proceed directly to the operating theatre for exploration and repair. So with these sort of cases, you don't know necessarily where the injury is. And depending on which part of the artery is injured could drastically change your surgical approach. So for, you know, pure axillary arteries or very proximal brachial arteries, getting an infraclavicular control of the axillary artery is absolutely standard and fine. But the more you become proximal, then you're going to have to think about getting subclavian control at the supraclavicular approach, which in itself can be quite challenging, avoiding things like phrenic nerves and fat pads and ignus anterior, etc., can make things quite difficult. We're all worried of a particularly long bladed weapon. It's not out of the realms of possibility that a more proximal great vessel injury could have been injured, in which case you're looking at gaining proximal control by sternotomy. So I think a CT angiogram in patients whose physiology allow it, as in this case, is a very sensible and completely worthwhile procedure.
Thanks very much for talking me through that. So you've now found the axillary artery injury. What's your thought process in the choice of repair?
So there's some useful guidelines, and I happen to be sitting, or we are sitting, with one of the authors of the European Society of Vascular Surgeons, who have written guidelines for managing traumatic vascular injuries. And for this case, with a tension-free anastomosis as possible, that's exactly what was performed. So here we did, I think it was 5-0 proline end-to-end anastomosis. I guess other options that we can consider would include interposition grafts, where you can either use a synthetic or a piece of vein, a reversed vein graft, or the endovascular approaches that we sort of touched on earlier. So I guess the other thing to consider as a last resort would be an extra anatomical bypass. Once we'd repaired this gentleman's axillary artery, we tested distal flow with ultrasound at the wrist and had good Doppler signals, which was reassuring with the clinical signs of a warm, well-perfused hand.
Okay, thanks very much for talking us through what sounds like quite a challenging operation. So you've successfully done your repair. Here's a slightly controversial topic. What's your thought on heparinization, either in or after the operation, in vascular repairs?
Thanks, Prash. I mean, that is a fairly controversial topic, and I'm at risk of somewhat embarrassing myself by quoting the guidelines back to the author here. But my understanding of the European guidelines is that they say that we should be doing this on a case-by-case basis, and that if the patient is, you know, frankly coagulopathic or has a significant head injury as well as their vascular injury, then we should probably be thinking about avoiding anticoagulation in the perioperative period. But the guidelines do recommend using antiplatelets such as aspirin for these vascular repairs. I guess there's some literature that can help us here. So there's a study in 2020, which is a meta-analysis of just over 1,300 patients. And they looked at 7 retrospective cohort studies that thought that in an isolated traumatovascular injury, intraoperative systemic anticoagulation led to better outcomes in terms of amputation rates, thromboses, which clearly is what we're trying to avoid here, reoperation, and the risk of deep venous thromboembolism. However, in a different cohort study from 2022 of over 1,000 patients from the PROVE-IT database, found that there was no significant benefit or harm from intraoperative systemic anticoagulation after peripheral vascular injury. So at the moment, I'd be guided then by the European guidelines and try and tailor the approach to the patient in front of us.
Yeah, and I think it's probably worth saying that, as in a lot of trauma, there isn't a huge evidence base out there. And, you know, from the European side, at least, and I know the Society of Vascular Surgery are going through a similar vascular trauma review and guideline process, is that we try to keep things as pragmatic and also as evidence-based as we were able to. And there is no real evidence, high quality evidence, suggesting one therapy other than over the other. Other than, obviously, as we discussed, patients who are profoundly coagulopathic, who have got a significant brain injury, probably would not benefit from systemic intraoperative anticoagulation.
Okay, thanks very much, both, carefully navigating through that leading question. So you've now successfully got out of the operating theatre. Roisin and Mr. Elwin, so coming on to the post-operative journey of this patient, Roisin, could you talk us through the major events of his post-operative stay?
Yes, of course. So the patient was extubated post-operatively and transferred onto the trauma intensive care unit, where he had one overnight stay. On the ICU the following day, day one post-op, was reported to have a warm, well-perfused hand, and so was stepped down to the trauma ward. Day two post-operatively, there was some concern on the trauma consultant ward round that the left radial artery pulse was difficult to palpate. However, the left arm remained warm and well perfused. And so a decision was made for an ultrasound duplex to assess the axillary artery patency. This reported monophasic flow of brachial, radial and ulnar arteries with limited view of the axillary artery due to swelling and dressings which were in place. Therefore, the on-call trauma consultant decided to request a CT angio, which subsequently reported stenosis at the site of repair and poor vessel opacification. On day 4, postoperatively in the early hours, the patient was taken back to theatre for takedown of the previous repair and short synthetic interposition graft.
Great. Thanks very much, Roisin. So some careful examination on the ward rounds and then some investigation. So once again, a lot to unpack in terms of postoperative observation and take back procedure. So on to you, Mr. Aylwin. Do you have a favourite way to observe your repairs postoperatively?
I do, Prash. It's called clinical acumen, I think is the best way. Obviously, you know, you need to take into consideration the patient's status immediately postoperatively. Was there a pulse there? Was there not a pulse there? Was the flow at the wrist only on a handheld Doppler, et cetera, et cetera. But assuming that a patient hopefully will have a palpable pulse at some point postoperatively, and sometimes weirdly, they don't necessarily immediately post-op as the vessels sort of ease out of their vasoconstrictive state, that pulse often will return. So, you know, if you've got a pulse there, it means that you have to assess the pulse at regular intervals. The pulse stops being there, something has happened, and that requires further investigation. I wouldn't routinely personally use a handheld Doppler. I think, you know, and some evidence would suggest that handheld Dopplers are not that sensitive in picking up issues, mainly because a lot of people don't really truly understand or are able to tell the difference between the different audible waveforms, which can be quite subtle. So for me, it's feel a pulse. If things have changed in that limb, then it's depending on availability, it would be a duplex ultrasound scan, which is incredibly sensitive in the right hands, or a CT angiogram, which is probably still the gold standard as things stand.
Okay, thanks very much for talking us through that decision-making, which investigation to go for, how to pick up a potential repair that's gone down. So let's say you were taking this patient back to theatre. Could you talk us through your approach to the previous repair, how you'd get proximal and distal control, and what's your choice of redo repair?
Yeah, sure. So I would say it depends on the timing. So here we're on day 2, and day 2 is, I mean, it's obviously not a perfect time, but it is a good time to go back in because the planes are still fresh. If you're talking more than a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, life becomes a lot more difficult in terms of your surgical approach. But fortunately, in this case, we're on day 2. So it is simply just reopening very fresh wounds, and actually getting control at the previous site is normally very straightforward. So again, you would gain proximal and distal control. At this stage, I would be heparinizing the patient, assuming that there is no other contraindication. In other words, his coagulopathy has been resolved and this particular patient hasn't got a brain injury. So I would fully anticoagulate him before clamping the arteries. And then it's a question of taking down the anastomosis with a pair of pot scissors, angle pot scissors, and seeing what's happening. So is it a technical issue? Or is there too much tension, and seeing what the options are. And the options are restoring inflow and backflow with the use of Fogarty balloons and making a decision and a judgment there whether to repeat the repair, the previous primary repair, or cutting your losses and going for an interposition graft. And in this case, they've decided on the latter, which, you know, I'm not going to say was the wrong thing to do, because it's purely on what the operative surgeon finds at surgery and their preference. Certainly, again, citing the European guidelines, the advice is that using synthetic short interposition grafts are no worse than using autologous vein, and this was used in this particular case. We could talk about extra anatomical bypasses. That's getting into areas that in a trauma scenario is probably less optimal.
the patency long-term is probably significantly less than if you can keep a short interposition graft within the actual field of injury itself.
Yeah, thank you very much for talking us through that. So you've touched on quite a controversial topic there, which is the 2025 ESVS guidelines do suggest that there's no trauma-specific evidence to show that a synthetic graft is inferior to autologous vein in a short interposition graft. But it's been historically accepted that, especially in occlusive disease context and the military context, that a synthetic graft might be more likely to become infected or occluded. However, the most recent guideline suggestion is that a synthetic graft is much more likely to fail predictably at the suture lines rather than a vein graft sort of disintegrating all over the place, which may then make it a more difficult redo procedure as well. I don't know if you, either Max or Mr. Elwin, you've got anything more to add to synthetic versus vein.
Look, I think, you know, it is unquestionably, I suspect, for people outside of the writing group and even perhaps within the writing group, a slightly controversial topic here. You know, we as vascular surgeons have had it drummed into us from the day one of training that vein is always best. And most vascular surgeons would say, do your best bypass repair, whatever it, certainly in an elective setting, do your best bypass with the best graft that you possibly can, which traditionally is always vein. But the evidence doesn't necessarily back that up in trauma. And what the ESVS guidelines stress is that it needs, whatever repair you do, the shortest graft possible is going to give you the better outcome. And that in a short graft, synthetic is no worse either in terms of patency or certainly in infective complications worse than vein, and has the advantage of potentially reducing your operative time and therefore allowing hopefully normalization of physiology to occur at an earlier and better stage of the patient's journey. The other suggestion is that as you've touched upon, Prash, is that a synthetic graft is likely to fail in a more predictable way and a slower way and a better way than potentially a vein. And so, you know, it will tend to fail slower and then give you other options should it then fail down the line in however many months or hopefully years of the patient's life. So for me, I'll be honest, I still struggle sometimes, depending on the patient's physiology, with using synthetic graft. But yeah, the evidence, certainly, at least from the ESVS guidelines, or the recommendation is fairly clear on that. And it'll be interesting to see what the SVS, if they come up with a similar or competing viewpoint.
So that brings us towards the end of this patient's journey. However, in the London Major Trauma System, we're big proponents of holistic care from primary prevention to pre-hospital to the emergency department to the operating theatre to post-operative care and rehabilitation and on to secondary prevention. So, Roisin, could you briefly tell us about this patient's post-operative rehabilitation and the role of secondary prevention organisations like the Royal London Hospital's After Trauma Team or St Giles's Trust?
So, as you mentioned, beyond the immediate life-saving interventions, a crucial aspect of the trauma service does involve these secondary prevention organisations, such as the After Trauma Team and St Giles. The After Trauma Team is a group of experienced nurses and physios, and St Giles service is a trauma service violence youth reduction project. And this patient also had input from the trauma psychology team. In this particular case, our patient benefited significantly from the St Giles trauma service. This team specializes in supporting 11 to 25 year olds who are admitted after interpersonal injuries, and their core mission is to reduce readmission rates. They provide vital pastoral care and ensure the patient has a safe place to return to, act as advocates for the patient's needs, and assist with employment, education, and reintegration into the community. Additionally, the patient received invaluable input from the After Trauma Team and the Major Trauma Psychology Team, recognizing the profound emotional and psychological impact of a traumatic event. And it's these collaborations which truly underscore our commitment, not just to saving lives, but rebuilding them.
So thank you very much, team, for talking through this challenging case. We've unpicked a lot there, discussed a lot of controversial topics, and also brought out some areas of excellence as well. So summing it all up for our audience as a quick hit summary for the Behind the Knife podcast. So firstly, junctional vascular injuries carry a higher mortality risk than isolated torso or extremity injuries. And the fact that this patient got through to the ED and then even physiologically fit enough to get through the CT scanner and then buying the in-hospital clinician's vital time to plan their procedure is entirely down to the pre-hospital clinicians being able to successfully pack this difficult junctional injury and the pre-hospital interventions of pre-hospital blood and goal-driven transfusion to try and get the physiology better to get us to the best possible state at arrival at the trauma bay. So secondly, pre-hospital blood product resuscitation was likely beneficial for the traumatically injured patient with hemorrhagic shock. Next, a 1-to-1-to-1 major hemorrhage protocol for goal-driven balanced transfusion is the current standard of care in the trauma bay. Next, the CT trauma series in a fluid responder may help the surgeon make operative planning decisions in these tricky junctional injuries, as well as open the possibility of endovascular interventions as well. Next, at the index procedure, opt for a primary direct repair, such as a suture or patch repair, then an interposition graft, then an extra-anatomical bypass as a last resort. Try and keep your repair as short as possible, as long as it's tension-free. Next, consider using synthetic graft materials for interposition grafts and bypasses, which may be quicker, though this is still controversial, as we've touched on already. Next, consider systemic heparinization on a case-by-case basis, as long as there are no contraindications, and aspirin single antiplatelet therapy for patients who have had a vascular injury repaired. And lastly, remember victims of violent crime, that there's little point in your painstaking, technically perfect repair if the patient doesn't get rehabilitation support and attempts at secondary trauma prevention, and they just bounce straight back into your ED a few days later with another injury. So thank you very much for listening, and looking forward to joining you again in a few months' time for our first trauma subspecialty journal review. We've talked about a lot about different papers, referenced them throughout our podcast, and also picked up on some guidelines. If you're interested in reading through the resources, please see our reference list alongside the transcript. And if you're interested in learning more, then the Queen Mary University of London MSc in Trauma Sciences covers all of these such cases and the literature behind some of the decision making as well. For our American listeners, dominate the day. And for our UK listeners, cheerio.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.